What a show we have for you today on The People's Game. Pacifica Radio's coverage of the 2010 World Cup soccer tournament in South Africa. Yes, the games have begun, and the first goal was spectacular as the whole spectacle in Johannesburg, South Africa, where South Africa and Mexico played to a 1-1 draw as the entire world was watching. And the undercard for the day, slightly less entertaining, but a tense and very interesting match nonetheless, a 0-0 draw between France and Uruguay. And to make sense of it all, we have no fewer than 9 guests on the show that will be joining myself and my co-host for today, Pablo Morales, director of the film Gringos at the Gate, about the USA-Mexico soccer rivalry. First up, we'll be talking to executive director of Global Girl Media, Amy Williams, who, yes, was inside Soccer City watching the game live among the 95,000 in Johannesburg. And then we'll hear from a diehard Mexico supporter, Fernando Romero, his take on El Tri's performance today. After that, we'll be joined by Paul Mason. He himself is a diehard soccer fan, but you may know him as the economics editor of the BBC show Newsnight. Paul Mason will give us the lowdown on the English national team on the eve of their opening match against the USA. Following that, we'll look back at the France-Uruguay match. We'll have a preview of Nigeria versus Argentina, which will be followed by a conversation between myself and Pablo about Team USA, just what are their prospects for the 2010 World Cup. And we'll wrap the show up. Instead of looking at the field for the South Korea and Greece match, we'll look at the political context in which the World Cup is taking place within both of those nations, as both South Korea and Greece are currently global hotspots. What does it mean when a society's in political crisis and yet everybody's attention turns to the soccer field where their national team is playing? All that and more on The People's Game here on Pacifica Radio. And welcome back to The People's Game. This is Alan Minsky. And I am now speaking with Amy Williams, Executive Director of Global Girl Media, an independent media project. And Global Girl Media was at the stadium, Soccer City, in Johannesburg, at the match. Amy was there. Amy, I'd have no other question than tell us about it.
Well, it's really hard to describe the excitement and the colors and just the historic moment of hosting the World Cup in Africa, in South Africa, watching the opening ceremonies, you know, celebration of everything that is African, from the music to the rhythm. It opened with the older women, sort of the elders of the community, marching onto the field, and representatives from all the different African nations singing and dancing. And nobody really knew, you know, what the outcome of the match was going to be. But I think the South African team had the entire continent behind it and the entire South African community and country behind it. And so to draw with Mexico was, somebody that was with me at the match said, we dared to dream after the first goal. And you could kind of feel what that was like. Everybody was holding their breath to hope that that first goal would hold through the end of the game. And of course it didn't, but there were Mexicans sitting, you know, right in front of me and behind me. And there was just this feeling of brotherhood and unity. And when we were walking out of the stadium, nobody really speaks Spanish down here, but they were trying. And I think there was just this feeling of celebration. And it's like everybody says it's a different World Cup. It's just different.
I mean, obviously, I'm speaking to you from Southern California, a region which where so many people are rooting for Mexico. And between Mexico and the southwestern United States, they were sort of trying to turn the whole world off by winning the match and defeating South Africa. But I was so happy to see the first goal from South Africa. You could feel the whole world lift, let alone the stadium. So actually, just for that, what was that moment like?
Well, actually, it was a beautiful goal.
It was amazing.
The entire game was the beauty of soccer. It was like anybody who loves soccer would have really enjoyed this game because, you know, just watching the passing and the precision and the communication between the players, it was just, for me, having played soccer and why I'm down here, which I'm here because I'm representing an organization that's giving voice to the game from a woman's perspective. I just think everybody was sort of celebrating a different angle on what it means, what the World Cup means. And I think there's definitely different interpretations about the symbolism of the World Cup happening because it is in Africa.
Again, I was about to say a moment ago, the South African coach is, of course, has won a World Cup with Brazil. And from my point of view, he was quite the brilliant halftime tactician because he packed it in more, relied on counterattack, didn't try to play the midfield with the Mexicans who had dominated the first half with their tight, beautiful precision passing and control of midfield. He packed it more in, went on counterattack, and that was just a divine goal and a spectacular moment in the history of global soccer, I felt. Unfortunately, I think the Mexican goal that came back, and I think Mexico deserved a draw in the match, was it did seem to be, I haven't read the journalism after the game, but it did seem to be a defensive error where there was miscommunication around the other defenders moving up for an offside trap. And one player lingered back. So you were there with a group of girls, high school girls from Soweto, correct, with Global Girl Media?
Well, actually, they were not inside the stadium, but we marched about 2.5 kilometers with them, covering kind of the excitement. You can't underestimate the importance of having this match happening here in Johannesburg and opening the World Cup here. And to watch them, I want to just share with you a moment. They were covering kind of the traffic jam on the way to the stadium and getting their way there and how hard it was to get there, just the infrastructure and getting ready for this World Cup for this country was a huge, huge achievement. And so to watch these girls celebrate that achievement, because there were a lot of naysayers, there were strikes, there was some negative press, and to watch these teenage girls just celebrate the fact that it was actually finally coming together in a really sweet way. And they came across this Mexican guy. I have to say he was he came out of nowhere, and he was kind of hobbling along with a big sombrero. It looked like he had walked all the way from Mexico. And they asked him, you know, like, what do you think about the game and why are you here? And he said, you know, we're two societies that are very similar. We have these violent histories and we're both going through difficult times right now. You know, they're similar, they're dissimilar, but we're coming together on the soccer field. And it was just this moment where these young women who, you know, they hadn't experienced apartheid, but their parents and their grandparents had. And who knows who this Mexican guy was and where he was from and how he even got to South Africa. But there was this communication between the two of them, different generations, different countries. But it was just a very powerful moment for me to watch it happen.
Yeah, no, the global coming together that the World Cup represents, in many respects, this is why we're doing the show here, which is that, I mean, there's people who, for a serious political talk radio station like KPFK, thought it's not a good idea to do a show about the World Cup soccer tournament. But it is simply the most popular cultural event in the world, and therefore it's an amazing window into humanity and to these kind of expressions of solidarity across cultures that occur and that you captured so beautifully there. So I so look forward, by the way, to bringing some of the girls who were reporting from Global Girl Media onto the People's Game. Amy, your final thoughts at the end of the day about everything that you saw and being inside the stadium?
Well, it's bigger and better than I ever thought. And, you know, I never really dreamed that I would have this kind of experience in my own life. And I just have to say, you know, the game itself is one thing, I guess, for athletes and for people who are fanatics about soccer. And I just want to say for those people listening to your show that have never really thought that the World Cup meant anything to them or that it's not really worth following, it really is a metaphor for what we're lacking in this world, which is, you know, whatever you're lacking in your own personal world, it's just a wonderful thing to watch and participate in. And it breaks down barriers and borders, and it brings together, you know, for me, watching Mexico play South Africa as an American in the stadium, it was just a privilege to witness, I guess, like this feeling of nobody ever focuses on these cultures in a way that gives them right. Center field.
Right.
Yeah. So, and there they were. They were at the center of the world. All the eyes were on them. Everybody was watching them. And it's much more about, it's about soccer, but it's also about hope and humanity. And I was just blown away just being able to be there. And I'm still shaking because it's so hard to describe. And I would encourage your listeners to go to www.globalgirlmedia.com. It's a really small NGO. We're here on a shoestring. It was just a dream of a bunch of women trying to get more young women involved in the sport and in the spirit. And that's it.
Well, and of course, there's a second half of Global Girl Media, which is Los Angeles-based, and we will bring those girls onto KPFK in a few days as Mexico moves into their second match, and we'll get, and also as Honduras. We understand there are people with Global Girl Media here in Los Angeles who are going to be attentive to the play of Honduras. So we'll be hearing more from Global Girl Media, and of course, we hope to hear again from Amy throughout the course of the World Cup. Thank you so much, Amy, and I hope you can
get a little rest
after what must be one of the most exciting days of your life. Thank you.
Yeah, it was a great day.
And yes, it was indeed quite a dramatic match today. South Africa won and Mexico won. You know, I've been talking to people around Southern California, and I said, you know, diplomatically, it might have been the best result for Mexico. It was an exciting match. Mexico didn't defeat South Africa, therefore quenching all the enthusiasm in South Africa. And they got a point. They're alive. I'm joined now by Fernando Romero. Spoke to him for yesterday's show. We talked about how Mexico really can play such a beautiful game, and they started out that way. Then they seemed to wilt as the match progressed. Your thoughts on the match?
Well, like you said earlier, South Africa won, Mexico won. They both won. I think this is probably the best outcome for both teams. Specifically, I think Mexico deserved more. They played a little bit better. South Africa played their game, which was very Parreira-esque. You know, the style of we're going to play a little bit more defensive and wait for the counterattacks, which that's how they scored eventually. And Mexico did. There were moments where the team, you would have thought they were going to self-implode, because Mexico and a lot of players, specifically Rafa Márquez, has a history of doing that. But Rafa Márquez, ironically, is the one who's nailed the tying goal. So I think Mexico deserved a little bit more. They dominated the first 15, 20 minutes of the game, but South Africa was able to hang in there. And, I mean, both teams deserved the tie.
With the tie between Uruguay and France, it's all four teams in Group A with 1 point. It figured to be a very close group. And really the wild card for Mexico was the fact that the side that figured to be the weakest was the home side, so they weren't going to be the weakest. So in many respects, they survived to play another at least 2 days.
This first game was definitely the wild card game. I think this game it was going to be a hit or miss. And after this, they have two games. And just the fact that Uruguay and France tied 0-0, it only benefits Mexico, and it benefits South Africa as well, which is everybody wants the South Africans to go to a second round. And I mean, just the fact that the first match day, only two goals, one side each, and that puts South Africa and Mexico at top two right now. What I saw today was a very good Mexican team who moved the ball around. They changed it up in the second half, bringing in Cuauhtémoc, who was just like a talisman for this team, who just...
Yeah, and the thing too is they showed themselves to be vulnerable, very vulnerable to speed in the counterattack. But at least with France, France won't be counterattacking against them, because they'll probably dominate the balance of play. And Uruguay just doesn't have the speed to really do what South Africa did in counterattack. So on balance, I think Mexico's probably sitting pretty within the group after the first day. It could have been a traumatic day for them. The flip side is they could have traumatized the world, and neither happened.
Definitely, I think both teams could go at the end of the game. They were very satisfied. But I also think that South Africa, if they want to move to the second round, they have to step it up. And I think Mexico deserved a little bit better. But I think at the end of the night, everybody's satisfied.
Well, thank you so much, Fernando Romero, for joining us again.
Thank you.
Our expert analyst on Mexico.
Thank you.
And welcome back to the People's Game. This is Alan Minsky.
And Pablo Morales.
And tomorrow we go back onto the Field of Glory that was turned to in 1950 and 1776.
Don't forget 1812.
And 1812, right. Well, let's talk 1814 more than 1812. Okay. 1812 was a little bad. 1814 was a little better. But anyway, it's USA versus England, and it is the first match, of course, for both sides. And USA sure doesn't have a lot to lose. England's got a hell of a lot to lose, you'd think. And we're joined now by Paul Mason, economics editor of the show BBC Newsnight, fantastic blog called Idle Scrawl. Welcome to the People's Game, Paul Mason.
Oh, thank you. I'm honored.
Okay, so here's England. This team exists under a microscope 365 days a year. Now they finally have to take the field. They were brilliant in qualifying. What do you expect for game one?
Well, England go into this first game a little troubled because they've lost their one of their key defenders, Rio Ferdinand, Manchester United defender, went into the first training session and tore his knee ligament. So he's gone home. So there's a replacement out for him, and that's not great because he was also the captain. You will probably know that he was only captain because there was a scandal inside the team where one guy had a relationship with another guy's girlfriend. So there's been a little bit of trouble going into this. That having been said, they are pretty confident because these England players, if you look at the average age of the key people, leaving aside our star Wayne Rooney, who's 24, many of these guys are in their second or third World Cup. They're in their late 20s, some in their early 30s. And I think they feel, with a winter setting, playing the game at their own pace, playing a very physical game, they're certainly up for it. And so there's great anticipation here about the game with the United States.
I look at the British side. I see about five absolutely world-class players at certain positions. You know, Terry, Lampard, Gerrard, Wayne Rooney, Ashley Cole. The other six, maybe, there seem to be a rung below the other top teams.
Not to mention goalkeeper.
Right.
We haven't even decided who our goalie is. I mean, look, the most amazing thing when you look at the teams, I've been scanning through Wikipedia today, just idly, looking at the teams that are in this tournament. But if you look through the England team, every single one of them plays for an English club. They play for a club in their own country. It's almost impossible to find that kind of lineup anywhere else. Now, when you say they're not world class, I think that's absolutely true. The second tier may not be world class. But what you've got, I think, for the first time in many years for an England team, is a manager who can work with a squad that doesn't have to be world class. Because Fabio Capello is a rigid disciplinarian. He is a system guy, and he has brought system to the England team. I mean, we've just had an interview on British television with Wayne Rooney, where he talks about they're not allowed to leave the table before everybody has finished eating. And this is new for them. So it's a little bit like a boot camp. That's what makes us quite confident that some of these second-tier players can actually step up to the mark.
And I think they're not allowed to leave the table and go make love to their wives, right? Isn't that off the table?
There's no wives this time. There's no wives or girlfriends. That was the big problem last time.
Yeah.
It was a little bit like a sort of celebrity reality TV show in 2006 because they brought their wives, they brought their agents. We had a disastrous 2006. But Capello has put this right. And more than that, on the pitch, what he's done is introduced system. Now, there's a big debate here about the whatever the system should be, because our key man, I mean, he is head and shoulders above almost any player in the tournament, I would say, with the exception of Messi of Argentina. Rooney likes to play on his own up front for Man United. And in this system, Capello's going to make him play two up front. And against you guys, that's going to be quite tough, I think. So the system is with us. The force is with us. The force of discipline is finally with us.
Now, I always find that over the years, as I've talked to Englishmen who are a part of the football game, they often come off immediately as saying, well, you know, it was the game that we created. We know what's best. And they often look down upon or had in the past, you know, the Spanish league or the Italian league or whatever else. It was all unimportant. And then now after Sven Eriksson, of course, first, but now if they do have success since 66, now with an Italian coach, won't that rub a lot of the true believers in the Brit first crowd?
That belief, I think, has long gone. We've learned our lesson on the international stage that we may have invented it, but what we have been terrible at is system. I think Coach Bradley of the United States is his background is interesting. It comes from, I think, college soccer. It comes from minor and major league soccer. It's American soccer. And we know, and I think we're quite respectful of the fact, that you guys train in a way that you borrow some of the techniques from NFL. You borrow the idea of coaching individual little parts of the squad to do little bits. You know, it's not long ago that our guys just wandered onto the pitch and said, hey, football, let's play, because that was our culture. So we know we're catching up in many respects with this technical aspect of the game. And I don't mean the technical at the individual level, but the technical at the level of the sub-squad, the defense, the offense, the goalie, the set pieces. I think under Sven-Göran Eriksson, there was a problem that he just gave in to the importance of individual players, above all Beckham. But now, it's kind of good for England that we haven't got a Beckham. We've got Rooney is a simple soul, an entirely talented footballer, not going to win the Nobel Prize for philosophy. And he's going to obey what the manager tells him to do, hopefully keeping his temper in the process.
Right, he shouldn't get the wrong lesson from Zidane's headbutt, where Zidane becomes an even greater hero in the world after doing
that. Well, that whole Zidane thing still makes me very, very mystified why that happened. I mean,
I'm an Italian partisan, as you know, Paul, and for me it was because the guy couldn't break through the damn defense.
Yeah, but the whole thing about his mother, that was going on all the match. Why did he choose the last kick of the ball?
Because he couldn't break the defense down.
You know, Zidane made a film about himself. There is a feature film, a movie, you can see in the cinema, about Zidane, and most of it is in slow motion. Zidane knew this was being filmed. There were 21 cameras on him. And the key moment of it, which I think slightly annoyed the director, is that Zidane got himself sent off.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, look,
touche, great point, actually, in the Zidane mystery.
We're watching today, of course, one of the Uruguayan players has been sent off for, first of all, rolling the ball away at a free kick, and then quite a nasty tackle. But, you know, it's very clear. I mean, my theory about this World Cup is that the most coached and most disciplined team will win it. That's why I think I've tipped the USA as a dark horse candidate for maybe even going to the final, because any of this discipline stuff is just going to be, you know, because of NFL, that the slightest infraction of the rules, the slightest problem with discipline, gets you real serious penalty in the sport. For many years, football hasn't been this way. Soccer hasn't been this way.
Especially in England.
But no, it is.
Well, I'm guessing you're not going to. You're thinking Argentina doesn't go deep into the tournament, then, if that's your prevailing theory.
Well, yeah, but I mean, look, they've got the genius. They've got Lionel Messi. They're absolute genius. But
oh, good,
I
you weren't talking about Maradona.
I think some of the. My theory about this tournament is you get the disciplined squads, which will include the United States, and also the squads that have got an overriding kind of national story to tell. Obviously, some of the African teams have that, and it's a great advantage for them. But I'd be looking at Serbia. I'd be looking. I mean, remember, if you want to talk the politics of football, NATO bombed Serbia, I think, not long ago.
Early 90s.
And they've got a point to prove against anybody they go on the pitch against. They've got an incredible national story going on in that team. Serbia as a country has it. It's modernizing and renewing itself and putting the past behind it. And I think the Serbians are very, very talented as well, so watch them.
You know, they're certainly one of the teams that people have been picking as a dark horse because the talent's there. I do think within Group C it is interesting that USA's final match is against Algeria, the sole team from the Muslim world and from the Middle East. So there's something to play for. But I don't think the Algerians will have the strength that the Serbians have. On the field. Now, before we let you go, I want to talk a little bit about tomorrow's match in particular. Who do you think starts up front with Rooney? Is it going to be Crouch or Heskey, do you think?
They're looking at Heskey now. The word is it's going to be Heskey. I mean, that's not going to be a popular choice in Britain because Heskey is a veteran player. He misses the goal often from quite close up. He's 32. He's a big guy, but, you know, I think a lot of English football aficionados would prefer if we played what we call the 4-4-1-1 position whereby you put Rooney up the front and put a fast guy to play off him behind him.
Well, that's my – that was – I think I was talking to Pablo about this too, which is that my take on the American side, and this is a bit of a paradox for America. Traditionally, America has been stronger in defense and not had the talent, creative talent up front. This year they got more creative talent up front, Donovan Dempsey, and they are a little lumbering in the back. And the idea of trying to beat them in the air won't really be as effective as running Defoe at them. I think could really break, could really trip them up, have them trip over themselves.
Yeah, I don't think Defoe will start.
Right.
I don't think Defoe is almost there as a default player.
But I would expect
in case we want to play in a different way. But because he won't play off Rooney. What Rooney needs is somebody to feed him.
Well, I know, but
what's most likely now is if Heskey doesn't start there, then Joe Cole will start. And Joe Cole is not an attacking player. He's an attacking midfielder.
Right.
But he's been really good, actually, in the run-up to this. He's been injured all season, but in the last few games, really excellent.
Okay, now let me ask you to take a stab at the other side of the People's Game show. England, obviously, is one of the most prosperous countries in the world for the past few centuries. There's a great history of political contestation in England, but recently it seems that the political system is sort of gravitating towards the American system where the same politicians get recycled. Okay, maybe now Clegg's a little bit in the mix. Is there a significant social, political, cultural subtext that you see to this tournament as it plays out in contemporary British society?
Well, look, we just had an election, and we've got a coalition now. For the first time in many years, decades, we have a conservative-liberal coalition in Britain. So we have two parties that hated each other 4 weeks ago now govern together.
Right.
And as a result, there's a big mood of, wow, we're in a new situation. We're also seeing young politicians. Our Prime Minister was out in Afghanistan with our troops today. He's quite young. He stood there in his shirt sleeves and cracked jokes with them. We haven't had Prime Ministers who did that for a little while. So there's a feeling about a renewal in Britain. But above all, you know, our shirt sponsor is the sports wear company Umbro.
Mm.
It produced a version of our national anthem in which ordinary Brits sang stand up in the football shirt and sing the national anthem. Exactly 50% of the Brits pictured in that official advert are of ethnic minority origin. And that's the message. You know, our team is diverse. Our nation is diverse. It might be a story about South Africa, et cetera, and the post-apartheid. But the whole ethos, I think, of the British soccer team now is very much about that. It's about renewing. You know, I know in your country the word liberal is quite a sort of controversial thing, but in our country it's a sort of, it's very positive, and it feels like that's the ethos, really.
And then I know you also are the economics editor for BBC Newsnight. This is taking. I throw this question out. Sometimes it's a focus of an interview on this show. Occasionally I throw it out and I don't get much of a response back, but this is taking place in the context of a global financial crisis. It's the largest shared human cultural spectacle ever, as it were, because every 4 years the World Cup's the largest cultural spectacle and it's bigger each time. So it's taking place in the context of this huge economic crisis that's global. It certainly has impacted significant institutions in England. How do you see that plays into the 2010 World Cup?
There's an English aspect to the way the crisis is playing into this. And I think it's been pointed out by commentators here. Last time, we had a team with incredible hubris, incredible sort of almost stupidity, really. I mean, they lost it because they weren't managed. They were a bunch of individuals, and they had no discipline. They had incredible wealth and thought that would entitle them to win the cup. 4 years on, we're a chastened country. And I think you can tell that. It's part of the narrative here that our team is more disciplined. It doesn't matter so much that they are all millionaires. And actually, our football clubs, our great institutions, Liverpool, Manchester United, West Ham, you name it. I mean, some of them have gone bankrupt because they've all got the same problem that Wall Street have. They're all incredibly leveraged, in some cases, to American owners.
That's because you say both
because
those
of leveraged buyout. So we're all quite aware of that as well. As regards the tournament, I think the interesting thing is going to be that it's in South Africa. Anybody who makes it to South Africa really wants to go there. South Africa is not the most easygoing place to be as an ordinary person. There is high crime, there's high violence. But if it can be forged together among the Serbian, the Algerian, the English, the USA supporters. Some kind of common feeling. I think South Africa is the place to have that party. It's an incredibly, it's reinvented itself. And how many countries have done that?
Is there a lot of talk in England about the fact that for the first time in recent World Cups, the biggest contingent of foreign fans are from the United States and not England?
It's not really registered, actually. It's not registered at all. But I think you would probably say that's to do with... isn't it interesting that that is the case? Because it's to do with currency. I mean, our currency has collapsed. Euro is currently collapsing. So it's not actually that easy for your ordinary Brit to get the money together to go. I think, actually, the other part of this is going to be how many Africans from outside South Africa make it there. I mean, you will know, in many African countries, you go to a village, this is what they're talking about. The dream of every African football supporter would be to be there. And yet, for various reasons, it's going to be really hard for them to do that. I just think that what we don't yet realize is that South Africa is going to throw one heck of a party for the world because it's that kind of place.
Yes.
And we didn't. I mean, South Korea, bless them. You know, what isn't that kind of place? But South Africa is.
Well, the South Korean fans though had a unique take on that.
They had a unique take, but in terms of
very
fun-loving
unified
people,
take, yes,
you have to say. And also, you know, I don't know whether you've seen the pictures coming out of today.
Mm-hmm.
The crowds on the South African street have been incredible. Mm-hmm. Incredible. We have seen pictures of villages that have just been wired up to electricity. In South Africa, this still happens. Seeing their first football match on screen.
Mm-hmm.
We know it's an emerging market. You know, we call it the emerging market in economics, but you know, large parts of South Africa live a third world existence, and for them, the pride of this is fantastic. And I just have this hunch that, you know, fingers crossed, that the people who get there want to be there from the other countries, and they're going to be the right people to look at South Africa and say, you know what, they're kind of under an African sky and the incredible spectacularness of that landscape. Let's just party together in a way that, you know, we may not have seen before.
It certainly got off to a great start today in that respect. Last question then, going back to the game on the field, your expectations for tomorrow's match against USA. You've sort of implied that you expect a strong effort from the United States side against England, and then your expectations for England for the entire tournament.
Well, look, I think the USA will come out drilled. They will come out with their attacking front line really up for it. You guys have to just watch this. The moment we see our midfield or defense start delaying and worrying and being indecisive and putting passes into touch, which is the English disease in football because it's about the lack of system, that's when you've got us, I'm afraid, because that's so... redolent of many times before to us. What we all hope here in England is that our guys can actually buckle under into some kind of system type of playing that is so natural to you because your sports culture is about coaching and system and technique. And ours has been for so often about sort of messing about and improvising and eventually at the very last minute pulling it out of the hat. I mean, it's the 70th anniversary of Dunkirk this month, and that's our national way of doing things. At the very last moment, we pull a victory from defeat. It's not ideal.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on The People's Game. Paul Mason, economics editor of BBC's Newsnight. His blog is Idle Scrawl. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, let me tell you one thing, though. My prediction is 1-1, 1-1.
And how far does England go in the tournament?
Quarterfinals. We always get out in the quarterfinals.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Okay.
And this is Alan Minsky, and this is The People's Game. And now we're joined by Laurent Dubois, author of Soccer Empire, The World Cup, and the Future of France. So the first game is over for France. They played a rather unimpressive 0-0 draw against Uruguay that must have been extra frustrating as they had a man advantage in the last 10 minutes. This is not unfamiliar slow starts for the French side, but Sometimes that turns out okay, as in 2006, and sometimes it turns out terribly wrong, like in 2002. Laurent Dubois, what do you make of the result today and how this looks for the team for the rest of the tournament?
Well, I have to say, obviously, the result's disappointing, but also Uruguay is a really strong team and a particularly strong defensive team. I actually felt pretty good. I actually thought that they had a certain spark out there. They're finding their way, and there's obviously going to need to sort of shake out who's going to be the leaders on the field and how it's going to work. But there were some, you know, moments, some good moments and some good possibilities. So I think this is very common for the French team to start slowly, but it's certainly, I didn't feel incredibly discouraged, although obviously a win would have been nice.
Well, I think one of the really salient reasons to turn to you in particular for analysis of the French side is that the team has a sort of complex group psychology about it, almost a unique group psychology about it. And certainly in 2002, the team really failed to come together. And do you, however, are not worried that this team will, as of yet, still coalesce into a solid side?
I am not so worried, actually, as in the case of 2002. In a sense, I think that actually there was a moment in the game, a little bit late, especially when Henri came on, where you could kind of see a certain spark. And in particular, you saw them enjoying themselves a little bit. And actually, in some ways, that's what I look for when the French team seems to be having a little bit of fun and enjoying themselves and just trying to think their way through the problem. That's what they need to do. Now, obviously, you know, it's not a great situation right now, and there's a lot hanging over their heads. But seeing that, I thought, was good. I mean, I think there's a kind of really relentless and kind of negative talk about the French team. Obviously, they're certainly not a favorite, but I do think that they have a chance at least to do well in the next couple of games and possibly to move on through there. So if they can, it seems to me, actually, I think the psychology is decent, and there's a certain chemistry among some of the players. So the question is going to be maybe to shake out what configuration they're going to use, because there's obviously a little bit of uncertainty there. And I would, I think, like a lot of people, like to see Henri more on the field. I think he plays a really important kind of inspiring and leadership role and can do so on the field. So.
Well, thank you very much for that. And for what it's worth, my sense was is the team would be strengthened by a little bit more playing time for Laurent Malouda. Your thoughts on that very briefly?
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think Malouda and Henri at the end gave a certain amount of strength. But really, that could be key as well. But I think that, you know, it's just, you know, being a French fan is a bit soul-trying sometimes. It's so kind of up and down. But I think that in some ways this is a good beginning. And you know, it's interesting to see them out there. And, I think I actually enjoyed watching them play. I didn't feel as discouraged. I felt like there were some good moments. And, you know, they had a certain spark going on that hopefully they'll be able to maintain.
Okay, well, great. They certainly were a strong side that dominated the field of play. Thank you so much for joining us again on The People's Game, Laurent Dubois.
Okay, thank you very much.
This is The People's Game. I am your co-host for the day, Alan Minsky, and I'm joined again by Lazar Trishan from NoMoreOnionBags.com. Yesterday, he spoke with us about the Uruguayan team. They played France today, 0-0 draw. Most of the world's thinking that's a pretty damn good result for Uruguay in the first match. What did you think of it, Lazar?
Well, everybody's pretty happy. You know, we're tied now with 1 point with all the other teams, but we've played the best team in the group, so we've got the easiest road the rest of the way.
Well, we talked a lot yesterday, though, about the powerful strike force up front with Suarez and Forlan. That really didn't show too much potency, though, to the day. Does that worry you at all, or is it just a matter of the strength of France dominating the balance of play?
Forlan had his moments. I think Suarez is the type of player who is either really good or completely MIA, and today he was MIA. But despite the fact that the Uruguayan coach came out and said we're playing for the victory, I think it was pretty clear that Uruguay was playing for the draw, having lost the last time around in the first game. I think Uruguay was happy to get a point. So I'm not sure if it was a real test of the strike force, because they didn't get too much service.
And so you're confident going forward for the rest of the group stage that Uruguay, you obviously must have watched Mexico and South Africa. Your sense is Uruguay can match up well against those sides?
I think we've put ourselves in a position where we can go through. Let's face it, Uruguay is not a great team. We have two or three very good players in Forlan. Our center back, Godin, I thought was just a heroic performance today. Our keeper made a couple saves, but, you know, otherwise, it's a mix of guys who are pretty good, or a couple guys who showed perhaps they have no business being out there, or the moment was a bit too big for them. But we can't be anything but happy after both our result and the fact that nobody got 3 points in the first game.
Well, there always is the example of the Greek side in the 2004 European Championships, played defensive throughout, and they went home with the trophy. So it's possible for a country of under 4 million with two World Cup trophies still to dream.
Absolutely, and it was 90 minutes of suffering, especially those last 10 minutes with 10 men were classic Uruguayan fan suffering. What I'm just looking forward to is I could actually get to enjoy the World Cup for a few days until Uruguay plays again.
Hey, thank you so much. Great website, nomoreonionbags.com. Check it out. Lazar Trishan joining us again to talk about Uruguay, and we'll have him back on the People's Game.
Thanks, Al.